Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
And I'm Barbara Platts. A herd of goats has been hired to eat weeds along the Rio Grande Trail.
Colorado is considered the most creative state in the country.
And the least obese.
And we hear from a professional taxidermist.
That's coming up on Mountain Edition.
Registration for the Colorado Ski Country USA's 2016-17 5th and 6th grade passport programs opened last week. These programs give free or discounted access to all Colorado ski resorts, excluding only the expert grade Silverton. Barbara has more.
5th graders who register for the program get free access to each ski resort for 3 days, as well as lessons if they are beginners. 6th graders get a heavily discounted pass and 4 days at each ski resort. This program, which started more than 15 years ago as the first of its kind in the country, is meant to familiarize the younger set with winter sports in the state. Colorado Ski Country USA's communications director, Jennifer Rudolph, says that they are very proud of this program and that it's one of their favorite initiatives.
The passport was started because it was a great way for the ski resorts here to really introduce our kids to our state sports of skiing and snowboarding. It was one of the ways we could give them access to the slope, breaking down nearly all the barriers for them to be able to learn.
Prices for the 6th grade pass go up after November 30th.
Basalt's town attorney acknowledges that it may look like he had a conflict of interest when representing his boss at a legal proceeding earlier this summer. Carolyn Zachariasen reports.
Tom Smith, who is contracted to legally represent the town and its citizens, appeared with Mayor Jackie Whitsitt when she was questioned during a criminal investigation by the district attorney's office. Aspen Public Radio obtained the audio of the July 1st interview with 5th Judicial District Attorney Bruce Brown and his investigator.
Thomas Smith of the firm Austin Pearson Smith, appearing on behalf of Ms. Whitsitt.
And that's because you're the town attorney, correct?
I'm here as their personal attorney, as her personal attorney.
Okay.
The interview was related to an open records request by a citizen who was seeking text messages between the mayor and the town clerk leading up to the April election. Smith says he appeared on behalf of Whitsitt to find out the scope of the investigation and how it connected to a related civil case. He says that he told Whitsitt that she would have to get private counsel if the matter continued. He offered a mea culpa and says he will take the $600 he charged off the bill to the town. Carolyn Zachariasen, Aspen Public Radio News.
The U.S. Forest Service released a draft decision to reissue a permit for Western Adventures to lead guided snowmobile tours on public lands outside of Lonado. Elizabeth reports.
The permit, which is valid for the next 10 years, allows for up to 2,500 snowmobile visits to the backcountry each year. This more than doubles the operation, which had been previously allotted 1,100 so-called service days. Aaron Carey with the Forest Service says this amounts to an increase of 7 or 8 people per day, and this will not have a significant environmental impact.
It wouldn't be any net increase to the trails that are being groomed or the amount of traffic out there. It would just be a slight increase in users that are participating in the snowmobile tours.
Western Adventure Snowmobiling put the brakes on operations last winter while the Forest Service worked on an environmental assessment, which was completed earlier this summer. There were nearly 100 comments from the public during this process, many of which centered on traffic and parking concerns in Lonado. Company owner Howard Wagner says he'll be relieved when the process is complete and he can continue with tours. There is a 45-day objection period before the decision is finalized.
One of the Valley's longest working craftsmen is hanging up his tools this fall. Don Weckler has been a professional taxidermist in Glenwood Springs for more than 3 decades after a career with the Bureau of Land Management. Arts and culture reporter Patrick Fort visited Weckler in his workshop to see how he keeps hunter's trophies alive.
In his house, Don Weckler has what he calls his man cave, and on the walls, decorations. But you won't find sports jerseys or movie posters. You'll find a moose, elk, bighorn sheep, a grizzly bear in the corner, a mountain lion, a turkey, so many others, dozens of taxidermied animals.
You know, when you're starting your own business, your motivation level is maxed out, you know. I mean, you don't mind breaking your back 7 days a week if you're working for yourself.
Wickler started his taxidermy shop, Slim's Taxidermy, over 30 years ago. Slim is an old nickname.
Back then was skinny as a rail.
So first, he receives the pelt of the animal. Right now, he's working on a mountain lion.
We've done things like full-body musk ox, you know, life-size grizzly bears. Those real big things are kind of a chore to wrestle around.
He has the job of cleaning off excess fat and flesh so the skin can be turned into leather.
I do lots of stitching. You know, it's not uncommon for, you know, there to be cuts here and there and everywhere on a mount.
Next comes the difficult part, pulling the skin over a foam and wood cast of the animal. It's kind of like one of those anatomical humans you see in health class. It's got veins and muscles all carved out to add an element of realness to the finished product.
There's, of course, 101 other little details.
It's all assembled with glass eyes, plastic mouth parts, teeth, and tongues. Then it gets sent off to its new home. And after 3 decades, Weckler is retiring right as hunting season starts again. So what would he do differently?
Well, I really think I'd do the same thing. You always wonder what would have happened if I'd have, you know, stayed working for the BLM or whatever, you know, in wildlife or range. But, you know, you just make decisions and go with it.
He's going to finish up a few more projects, even though the sign outside says retired. Patrick Fort, Aspen Public Radio News.
Author Luis Alberto Urrea has been called a border writer, penning novels and nonfiction works cataloging stories of immigration from Mexico to the United States. Urrea recently held a series of talks to raise money for Valley nonprofit English in Action, which pairs English-speaking locals with those trying to pick up the language.
Urrea sat down with Aspen Public Radio's Allison Bechtesh before an event at Explore Booksellers. Urrea says he very much identifies with the demographic English in Action works to support.
You've got to understand that I am those folks, particularly when the immigration people started raiding here in town. And all of a sudden, Aspen was half closed, and people weren't daring to come to work. So they asked me to go down valley and talk. And I love those folks a lot, and I like to try to give back if I can.
You've been here several times in the event in Carbondale. Did you get to speak with people who got to this valley not knowing English?
Oh, yeah.
How does learning it change who you are, how you relate to everyone else?
It's utterly transformative because, you know, a lot of the folks down valley are already shadow dwellers, you know, by the circumstances they find themselves in. But then they're further held away by that wall of language. You know, that battle is always continuing, and they need catch-up help. And I think a lot of times in America, especially right now, especially with the Trumpian tones that we're hearing, you know, people seem to think that if we help those folks, it's taking something away from us. But the reality is you're creating a whole new backbone for the United States. And it's about our future, not their future, as a union. And those young people are so... they're so good, you know, and they mean so well, but they're so ashamed and so crushed and so afraid. They don't want to step out. They don't want to be seen. And they hear every day that they're bad. You look at polls among those children, and the color brown is considered one of the worst words among school kids. And, you know, maybe they don't make the explicit link, but somewhere you've got to think, well, I'm not blonde and blue-eyed.
Well, and you... are.
I am.
Still had that experience as a kid.
Yeah.
Being told that you weren't.
Yeah. And I don't really understand it. I think you all grew up eating peanut butter sandwiches on a corn tortilla, not bread. And then it's a shock when people didn't. And I still had my Tijuana accent, you know. I've got people talk like this right now, you know, okay, my family talk like this. And they say, you know, you're pretty good. Your radio is pretty good. That's how they talk. And I was still talking that way when the people told me I was a greaser. And all of a sudden, what a miracle, I began speaking like my mother. Because I didn't want those people on my back. But you know, my brothers and sisters down in Carbondale don't have that option.
Author Luis Alberto Urrea is in the Roaring Fork Valley supporting the nonprofit English in Action. To hear his full address to the audience in Carbondale last week, go to aspenpublicradio.org.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elizabeth Stewart Severy. To stay up to date with news in the Roaring Fork Valley, follow us on social media. Like us on Facebook, find Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, or follow us on Instagram. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station.
Cyclists and runners along the Rio Grande Trail are seeing a different kind of wildlife this month. The Roaring Fork Transportation Authority has hired a herd of goats to eat weeds along the path from Glenwood Springs to Emma. Elizabeth spent an afternoon with the goats and brings us this report.
Colorado has 78 weeds on the list of noxious weeds that landowners must, by law, control.
And the goats eat every single one of them. They like all the poisonous weeds. They like anything with thorns on it.
That's Lonnie Malmberg, self-proclaimed gypsy and 21-year veteran in the goat herding business. She and her son, Donnie Benz, run the company Goat Green, and their herd of 210 goats will be browsing, not grazing, along about 10 miles of the Rio Grande Trail. Malmberg explains,
a grazer eats all grass, and that would be a cow and a horse. A goat is a browser, and they prefer trees, brush, weeds.
Which she says makes them ideal candidates for projects like this. The goats will spend this month eating weeds at top priority areas along the popular path. They eat constantly, more than a quarter of their body weight every day. And as Malmberg puts it, quickly recycle those plants as fertilizer.
So how do you measure success? Like, how do you know?
Species diversity, water held in the soil, you can measure that. Soil organic matter, nutrients in the soil, you can measure. And then over time, there'll be no thistle here, but instead there'll be other desired broadleaf plants.
Rafta workers have been seeding the ground ahead of the goats, so all those hooves work the seeds into the soil. A few more fun facts about goats. They have an enzyme in their saliva that allows them to digest serious poisons like hemlock. They have four stomachs. When they move, it looks a lot like a school of fish, sharing a bite each of all the weeds and shrubs and circling around as a herd. All goats have horns, and they use those horns to sweat and regulate their body temperature. They also only have bottom teeth. Malmberg's herd works every day of the year somewhere in the western United States and is comprised of cashmere goats, the kind that produce the world's finest wool. It's
very expensive. They make it. It's a byproduct of eating thistles. Isn't that cool?
Those thistles are a major part of Rafta Trail Manager Brett Meredith's job. He estimates that workers in his department spend more than half their time on a never-ending battle against noxious weeds. In the past, Meredith has used that bright blue chemical spray, shooting it from a backpack or a big truck tank. Last summer, Rafta workers used 464 gallons of herbicides, and Meredith estimates the total cost of the efforts at $60,000. He does not enjoy that work, and he says he's not seen improvement in the 4 years he's been on the job. So when he heard about these goats from a colleague in Blaine County, Idaho, Meredith jumped at the chance for a change.
And they have an old railroad corridor, so it's very similar, 20 miles, about 100 foot wide, and they had done this project, and he told me it was just as successful as spraying, and that's all I needed to hear, and then I was like, okay, we're doing this.
The idea of using goats as a form of weed control is not without its skeptics. Gary Tenenbaum, Assistant Director of Pitkin County Open Space and Trails, says his department has tried goats without much success. Meredith acknowledges that this is a slow process.
It's going to take time. Nature takes a long time.
Malmberg agrees, noting that this type of weeding requires a shift in thinking.
When people think of weed control, they think of spraying and mowing, usually. So it's a different paradigm where we're trying to build life and a chemical would be trying to kill something.
It will be years before the full benefits of all those goat mouths, stomachs, and hooves take effect. So the contract with the goats is for 3 years at $40,000 a year. Elizabeth Stewart Severy from the Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Hubbard Cave outside of Glenwood has been closed to humans since 2010, and the White River National Forest is proposing keeping it this way for the next 3 years. The move is an effort to prevent white nose syndrome, which has killed over 6 million bats in the eastern United States. Wildlife biologist Phil Nyland says that humans may transmit the fungus that causes white nose syndrome on their clothes or equipment. Elizabeth spoke with Nyland to learn more about the bats in this cave.
Why is Hubbard Cave so important in the bat population?
We know that Hubbard Cave has a large quantity of bats. It is an unprecedented number of bats for a Western cave site. At particular caves where white nose syndrome has appeared, more than 90% of those bats have died. So if white nose syndrome shows up, cave bats die. We want to prevent white nose syndrome showing up in the West.
What happens to bats with white nose syndrome, and how do you stop the spread of it?
Currently, there's no known way of stopping the spread of this fungal infection. But what happens to bats is if they get this fungus while they're hibernating in the wintertime, they're forced to go searching for food or deplete their fat reserves. And so it causes bats to starve to death because there are no food resources available for bats in the wintertime, or they deplete their fat reserves and die in the cave.
Can you explain why bats are important ecologically, or why should we be interested in bats?
What's most astounding about bats is their biology. They'll eat their equivalent body weight in insects each night in order to have enough food and energy to fly. The weight of a typical Colorado bat, like a little brown bat, is about the weight of 1 to 3 pieces of paper. And the bat's wings are comprised primarily of the forearm and the fingers. The fingers are very elongated. Pretty cool.
What would happen if we lost a large population of bats to white nose syndrome?
We could have a disruption in the food chain or food web where we have an imbalance in the number of insects and other animals that eat those as prey. Ecologically, it's been estimated that bats provide millions of dollars into agricultural communities and eating insects like moths and flies and things that eat crops and damage crops. So the loss of bats could have an untold ripple effect on the rest of the ecosystem.
That was wildlife biologist Phil Nyland talking with Elizabeth. The Forest Service proposal includes extending the closure of Hubbard Cave and installing bat-friendly grates. Public comment is open through Monday, September 12th.
Colorado is still the leanest state in the country, according to a new report from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. State reporter Benta Berkland has more.
Colorado's obesity rate is just over 20%. While it's the lowest in the country, it is twice as high as it was in the 1990s. Don Schwartz is the vice president for programming at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
As more and more people become obese, people get used to the weight of others. Like children in classrooms, look around and see a large proportion of other children who look like them, we lose sight of what it means to be obese and what it looks like to be obese.
Schwartz says this year's report points to some good news. Most states like Colorado have held steady compared to the previous year. And for the first time ever, 4 states, Minnesota, Montana, New York, and Ohio, saw reductions in obesity rates. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
Lisa Singer's latest show, called Storm, New Works, opens at the Art Base in Basalt on Friday. It's a collection of paintings of common objects, like houses and boats, struggling through chaotic storms. Singer spoke with Aspen Public Radio arts reporter Patrick Fort about her pieces.
All of the paintings you have in this show are based on storms. And first, I want to get at why that inspires you, why you chose to paint these figures in nature.
Yeah. Well, nature's awesome and storms are awesome. I'm always moved by them, and I do like to paint things that I'm moved by, of course. But for me, the storm is more like a metaphor for all the types of storms that I feel are around us in weather, in society, in relationships. I feel like we're in particularly stormy times right now in a lot of ways, and I wanted to work with that. I wanted to work into it and through it. I wanted to be illuminated by working with it.
Was there a moment when you kind of maybe collected or came to a realization that we are maybe living in dark times, and this is how you wanted to kind of express that?
Yeah, there was a time it kind of hit me like a storm. Exactly right about the beginning of January this year, if you're speaking literally about a time, January this year, I really wanted to focus on that feeling. It wasn't particularly dark in January. Well, of course, it was dark in January, literally, but it wasn't a horrible time. It was just a time when I felt like between the environment and politics and winter and some aspects of relationships in my own personal life, things felt very stormy and dark, if you will.
That was Lisa Singer. She spoke with Aspen Public Radio's Patrick Fort at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk. To hear more of their conversation, go online to aspenpublicradio.org.
You're listening to Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Barbara Platts. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Also online, you can sign up for Aspen Public Radio's new ForkFed digital newsletter. ForkFed comes out every Friday, updating you on the week's news in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond. Access to quality health care and a doctor can be difficult in the more rural areas of Colorado, especially along the Eastern Plains. That's why the state is embarking on a new training program to recruit and train more family practice physicians. Benta Berkland has the report.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
What can I do for you today? I hear you have a sore throat, huh?
Yeah.
Been bothering you for a while? Yeah.
Dr. Jeffrey Bacon has been a family practice doctor for 18 years.
Have you been running a fever?
No.
No? Okay. Feeling sick?
He's spent the last 16 of those years at the Sterling Family Care Clinic. It's about 2 hours northeast of Denver.
It's difficult to get people to come out and stay and retain here. The critical piece as well is if you can bring them back and see that they can have their passion in a small town and do what they want to do in a small town, it makes a huge difference.
But location is just part of the problem. Overall, the number of family doctors nationwide has been declining for a while. Wanda Feiler is the president of the American Academy of Family Physicians. She practices in York, Pennsylvania. She says family practice is still the most common choice for medical students.
We have over 11,000 residents right now, but that's still not enough because the population is growing. The data that I've seen from our own work suggests that Colorado is going to need 49% more family physicians by 2030. So there is, I think, it should be a strong state interest here to make sure that family medicine residency programs get what they need in order to expand and medical schools admit the students who are most likely to choose primary care.
State leaders have already commissioned a study looking at the current doctor shortage. The group released 14 recommendations on a variety of things, including funding a new program to provide loan repayment assistance for medical students who decide to practice in the state.
It's more challenging to get primary care clinicians in rural areas than it's been in the past.
Amy Downs is the vice president of the Colorado Health Institute, a nonpartisan healthcare think tank in Denver.
You have more females going into the primary care workforce, and they're less likely to select rural areas. You also have the issue of primary care clinicians very often being married to a professional spouse who sometimes might have a challenge finding a position in a rural area.
And that's a problem across rural parts of the state, and especially along Colorado's eastern plains. Downs says that region would need a 130% increase in doctors just to keep up with the industry benchmark of 1,900 Medicaid patients per physician. She says telemedicine can help, but that doesn't take the place of an on-site physician.
And it takes a special person to do this out here because you're on your own.
Adam McIntosh knows this firsthand. He's lived in Sterling for 10 years, but grew up outside of San Francisco. He admits that it took time to get used to practicing in this setting.
I don't have a big hospital 15 minutes away, you know, down the road. If we have a baby that's sick and we have to hold them and keep them safe until we can get the guys out of Denver. But that can be 2 hours, or if there's a snowstorm, which it seems like there always is, when the worst, it could be 24 hours.
Another thing that might help is a new state law that creates an income tax credit for people who teach and train medical students who want to go into family medicine. The State Commission also recommends a tax credit for physicians who practice in rural areas and loan forgiveness. Pete Banshoon is an intern at North Colorado Medical Center in Greeley and one of two residents who will soon spend the next 2 years working in Sterling. It's part of a new rural track residency in Colorado that gives residents more time to really understand rural life and what it's like to practice there. Banshoon is somewhat unusual because he says he knew he wanted to be in a remote area.
On the East Coast, it's almost unheard of for a family doctor to participate or even or do primary C-sections. That's all covered by, you know, OBs because, you know, along the East Coast, it's so specialist heavy. When you get into these truly very rural areas, the breadth is a lot wider. You get a chance to do things and train in things that I would not otherwise get to do.
Wanda Feiler of the American Academy of Family Physicians says it helps to train residents in the type of setting where they would likely practice. Paying doctors better is another way to attract those who are driven to more lucrative specialties. To that end, she says there is some good news. Salaries for family physicians have gone up by 17% over the last year. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
The National Endowment for the Arts released a huge set of data last week about art and participation in it on a state-by-state level. Aspen Public Radio's Patrick Fort looks at how Colorado fits in.
Colorado has the most creative people in the country, according to a nationwide study. Two-thirds of Coloradans say they personally perform in or create art. Other western states, including Montana and Utah, were at the top of lists, measuring participation and attendance in the arts. Margaret Hunt from Colorado Creative Industries says this attendance and creation of art is because of western states' efforts to bolster rural economies with art programs. She also cites Colorado's growing young population, as well as increasing access to technology, which allows easier creation of art. Hunt's group has only been able to measure employment statistics before this. It's the first time the National Endowment for the Arts has released state-by-state data since the agency started researching art participation in the 80s. Patrick Fort at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
Officials with Pitkin County Open Space and Trails are asking for public input on recent changes at North Star Nature Preserve. Elizabeth has the details.
A new management plan for the popular flatwater spot went into effect earlier this summer, and Pitkin County has partnered with several other government agencies to enforce rules about noise, litter, and parking. Environmental planner Lindsay Utter says parking along Highway 82, which is managed by the Colorado Department of Transportation, or CDOT, continues to be a problem.
No matter what, we need to work with CDOT, and we need to look at how we can make it safer.
The department is considering several options for changes to four parking areas, including a possible increase in the number of spots. Open Space and Trails has received almost 60 comments about the property so far through an online survey and targeted emails. The public can also give feedback at an open house tonight at 5 p.m. in the Forest Service Building.
A link to the North Star Nature Preserve survey is available at aspenpublicradio.org. That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Barbara Platts.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. To hear the show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. A panel of journalists will join Allison Bechtesh to provide analysis, insight, and commentary on the week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.